Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
I didn't know exactly what was going on, so I'm trying to play it kind of logically that, okay, well, she's probably going to come home. She'll get ready for school, and then she'll go to school, and she'll get in trouble for being out all night or whatever, and then we'll take care of it after that. She never showed up to school, and I think it was at that point where both Joanne and I started to really panic and really start to believe that something terrible has happened.
A couple of the boys that get off the bus with her said that she had stopped there and looked like she was texting on her phone and then turned to leave the neighborhood, which would have been in the direction of the burger barn. And that's the last that anybody has heard from her or seen her. There's been no activity on her cell phone since that day.
We've received hundreds, if not thousands, of tips over the years, and every one of them have been followed up on, and a lot of them are lookalikes. A lot of them are just never came to fruition, you know. So it's exhausting.
There's got to be somebody out there, you know, that knows something. Why aren't they coming forward?
On the afternoon of April 26, 2010, 16-year-old Alexandria Joy Lowitzer, or Allie as she was known, got off of her school bus across from her home in Spring, Texas. The small community just north of Houston was quiet after school, with most parents at work and school kids making their way home. Allie, a sophomore at Spring High School, wanted to walk up to her new workplace, the Burger Barn. She had a paycheck to collect, and she told her mom she might be able to pick up a shift that afternoon. Her mom, Joanne, was reluctant because Allie had only been working there for a few weeks, and she had never walked to work before. But Allie pleaded with her mom, Joanne, until she gave in. Two boys got off the bus with Allie and noticed that she lagged behind, not walking as she usually would towards her home, but going the opposite way, out of the neighborhood and in the direction of the Burger Barn. After this, Allie was never seen or heard from again. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 156 of The Vanished, Allie Lowitzer's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. 16-year-old Allie lived with her 18-year-old half-brother Mason and her mom, Joanne. Her parents had recently separated, and her father, John, lived nearby, but the family was still close. Allie had struggled, like most children do, during their parents' separation. But there was no animosity, and there had been no reason to believe Allie wanted to run away. She was pleased with her new job at the Burger Barn, and Joanne would drive her to and from work. Allie was known to be really quiet, so her new job was a big deal for her. She had a close group of friends and was outgoing with those she knew well. She was close with Mason, and that day in particular, she had forgotten her house keys, and so her brother originally waited at home to let her in, before finding out she wasn't coming straight home. I spoke with both Allie's mom, Joanne, and her dad, John, for this episode. Here's John talking a little bit about Allie.
Allie kept a very close circle of friends, so there wasn't a whole lot of people outside of her circle that she spoke with or interacted with. She was pretty much a homebody. She didn't really go to anyone else's house. She wasn't the type of person to want to leave the house and go out and have a good time with friends. She was probably more comfortable inside her home setting with her dogs and that, so she really didn't venture out much. You know, she played softball and things like that, but was really limited to staying at home. Then she'd go play softball, hang out with her friends there, and then, you know, just come back home. So she wasn't really like a social butterfly or anything like that.
The lead-up to Allie's disappearance seemed uneventful. Nobody who knew her felt that anything was out of the ordinary. Here's Allie's mom, Joanne.
The weekend directly before she was missing, it was a good weekend. I don't remember what we did that Saturday. Probably something with softball. And because I know we had just started the end of the season tournament. So we probably played softball or practiced softball. And then that Sunday, her brand new boyfriend, DJ, came over. And it was my first time meeting him. And he spent the day over here at the house. And, you know, they played around on a skateboard outside. They watched TV. I ended up cooking them some lunch. I don't remember what it was. And they played around on the guitar. Allie was learning how to play the acoustic guitar. So, you know, it was just a good day all around. It was just a typical Sunday. And, well, we'll back up to the weekend. The entire weekend before she went missing, we had gone camping with our Girl Scout troop. And I've got pictures of Allie catching her fish with her SpongeBob fishing pole, if you want those. She was so proud of that fishing pole. And she caught the most fish that weekend. It was a good weekend for her. We loved camping with our Girl Scout troop.
Joanne talked about the day and the lead up to Allie going missing.
That Monday morning that Allie went missing was just a typical Monday morning. You know, neither one of us wanting to wake up and get ready for work and school. And, you know, usually, you know, we're getting up and getting dressed at the same time. And she walks out the door a few minutes before I do. And she'll just, you know, holler into my room, you know, saying, "Bye, Mom." And, you know, that's it until I get home in the evenings. So it was uneventful, really. You know, nothing major going on.
Allie had a regular day at school. She talked with her friends as usual and had various conversations via text message. None of the kids remembered anything out of the ordinary either. You'll hear from Allie's parents how she had originally suggested that she would stay after school to do various things. She changed her mind a couple of times, and it wasn't until she was on the bus home that she asked her mom if she could go up to the burger barn. You'll also hear, a little later on, that Allie had asked a boy she knew to come over and hang out as well. One thing was clear, Allie seemed adamant to do something that afternoon. But it appears that she had finally decided that she wanted to go up to the burger barn first.
That Monday that she went missing, she had called and texted me a few times. She was trying to figure out her schedule for the afternoon. At first, she was going to stay and do some extra work for one of her teachers. And then she changed it to where she was going to get a ride home with one of the friends. And then she changed it again where she was going to ride the bus home. And she was wanting to walk up to the burger barn and get her paycheck. And You know, I was telling her, no, it's like just to wait till I get home, you know, drive you up there. Cause usually my mom was here at the house when Allie would get home every day. And, you know, she would do whatever, you know, with Allie until it was time for me to get home around 5:30 in the evenings. So, my mom wasn't able to be here that day. So Allie was really wanting to go up to the burger barn. And, you know, after me saying, no, 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 just wait. You know how kids, they know how to, you know, push your buttons and get what they want. So after a while of Allie begging and pleading and I'll be okay, mom, I'll call you when I get there, I gave in. And, you know, I told her, I said, you know, let me know when you get there and let me know, you know, if you're going to work, because she wanted to see if she could work too, because the schedule that the owner of the burger barn would give, it wasn't really a schedule. It would be basically, well, call me today and I'll tell you if you can work type of thing. And Allie had only worked there for, I think, 2.5, maybe 3 weeks. So, you know, it was Allie's very first job. It was brand new. So, you know, and it was at a burger place. So what kid wouldn't be excited to go to work?
As far as Joanne knew, Allie was going to walk up to work to collect her paycheck, and she may or may not pick up a shift as well.
After Allie got off the school bus here in the neighborhood, you know, the typical bus stop, she stopped at the corner just a few feet away from where the bus stops. A couple of the boys that get off the bus with her said that she had stopped there and looked like she was texting on her phone and then turned to leave the neighborhood, which would have been in the direction of the burger barn. And that's the last that anybody has heard from her or seen her. There's been no activity on her cell phone since that day. Because we live so close to the end of the neighborhood, and where the bus lets out is the road that goes around the neighborhood. So Allie was literally dropped off like the one road that leads to outside the neighborhood. And then when you get to the outside street, it's called Treshwig. There's only one house on that street. The rest is a few small businesses, a couple of churches. Allie would have had to pass her old daycare. And then, you know, that was the intersection. Me and John have clocked the distance. It's less than a quarter of a mile, if not exactly a quarter of a mile. So it would take her probably just walking normal, probably 15 minutes or less.
John had no idea anything was wrong until he got a call from Joanne later that night.
The understanding that her and Joanne had was that she was going to walk up to the burger barn, get her paycheck, see if she could work. So around 5:30 or so, Joanne comes home, tried to get a hold of Allie. Allie wasn't home, so Joanne tried to get a hold of Allie. Allie wasn't responding, and so Joanne just figured that, you know, she was working, couldn't answer her phone, couldn't be disturbed. And that happened for several hours up until around 9 o'clock, I think it was, when that's the time that Joanne would usually go and pick her up from work and bring her home. So Joanne decided, well, she hasn't called and she hasn't texted, so she's probably been busy. I'll just go up there and wait for her. When Joanne got to the burger barn, all the lights were off. The business was closed. All of the chairs were put up on the table just like a restaurant would be if it was closed. And it was at that time that Joanne had started to get very concerned, started to panic, for lack of a better term. She called me to see if I had heard from Allie or anything, and I hadn't. I think she called Allie's brother, Mason, to see if he had heard anything from her, and he hadn't. She started trying to call some of her friends. They hadn't seen or heard from her. So Joanne then went home and started to try to contact more people, seeing if she could find out where Allie was. And I think it was around 10:30, 11 o'clock when Joanne called me and was very concerned and said that she had called the local police to come and talk to her. The local police came and said, well, you know, she's probably off with her friends. Just call us when she comes home. And this was very uncharacteristic of Allie to not have contact with her brother, not have contact with her mom, and especially not have contact with her friends. She had just started having an interest in another boy named DJ, and they were talking a lot. And Joanne got a hold of him, went over to his house, and he said, no, I've been trying to get a hold of her too, and I haven't seen or heard from her. And I think that's really when the panic started to set in. I had thought that maybe Allie was going through a little bit of a rebellious stage, and she had decided to do something she shouldn't have done, and that she would probably be back by morning. And so the next morning, Joanne called me around 5 a.m. and said that Allie's still not home and she still hasn't heard from her. I didn't know exactly what was going on, so I'm trying to play it kind of logically that, okay, well, she's probably going to come home. She'll get ready for school, and then she'll go to school, and she'll get in trouble for being out all night or whatever, and then we'll take care of it after that. She never showed up to school, and I think it was at that point where both Joanne and I started to really panic and really start to believe that something terrible has happened.
Many parents tell me that they instantly know their child has not run away. For parents like Joanne and John, it's not even a consideration. When a teen displays no abnormal behavior and leaves no indication that they had planned on leaving, it's very difficult to reconcile that this is even a possibility. But again, like many families of missing teens, it's often the first thing brought up by law enforcement, and that's because it is so common.
I was told because there was no evidence of any foul play. Because, you know, we assured the law enforcement that Allie did not run away. She had never run away before. To me, that's just so wrong, knowing what I know now. I mean, you can't change the minds of law enforcement themselves, but I feel that something needs to change within the law that, you know, when a child goes missing, there's got to be some type of missing child alert that goes out other than just an Amber Alert. The Amber Alerts are triggered by law enforcement. So if law enforcement does not request an Amber Alert, then there's nothing that goes out about any missing kid. And then they want to use the label on top of runaway, endangered runaway. That means absolutely nothing to the general public, you know, from my point of view. Well, missing is missing. But, you know, that's a very, very frustrating to this day is that the most critical part of somebody being missing is the first 24 hours. And for us, it was like a week before they started taking any of it seriously. That night, the first police officer came to the house. There was no report taken. She just said, well, call us in the morning when she comes home. And then one thing that haunts me, you know, is like, what do we do if she doesn't come home? I mean, and really, what is the harm in getting the word out that there's a child that didn't come home? Really, what is the harm in that? And there's a stigma around it. Well, you know, then it's going to be like the little boy that cried wolf. You know, these kids are going to come home. Okay, that's great. That's great that Johnny from down the street just decided not to come home one day and he's home the next day. That's great. Everybody knows he's home. But what about all these kids that don't come home? And you know, there's a lot of people out there that don't know that you don't have to wait 24 hours to report a missing person. Although law enforcement will tell you, wait until tomorrow, that's not what the law is. There is no law that you have to wait.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Joanne and John had no experience with law enforcement. They had never imagined this situation, and so they were suddenly thrown into a situation where they were having to think on their feet and try to find Allie themselves.
You never think it's going to happen to you, or you never really think about it. You know, you might see something on the news and, oh man, that's sad, and that kind of thing, and then you go on about your daily business and you really don't give it another thought. And that's the same position that Joanne and I were in. We never in a million years would have thought this would have happened to us, but it did. And we were completely unprepared. And if we knew back then what we know now, we would have handled things a lot differently.
Hearing that Allie had never even made it to the burger barn was the moment that it became very clear. Something was really wrong.
The same day that Allie went missing, we didn't know what had happened because, you know, that when I got to the burger barn, they were closed. And so there's all kinds of scenarios that it could have happened. You know, Allie could have gotten there and then maybe she had left from there and went somewhere else. We had posted on Facebook that we didn't know where Allie was. So we had all kinds of information come in because me and John, we had made homemade flyers with our cell phone numbers on it. So everybody was calling saying, oh, Allie didn't ride the bus home. She walked across the street from the school to Burger King.
This tip about her walking across the street to the Burger King made them think that she hadn't taken the bus after all.
But John was the one that contacted the school and then contacted the bus transportation people. And they were the ones that actually showed John the footage where she did ride the bus home and she did get off right here where she was supposed to. So those first couple of days, we didn't know exactly if Allie did ride the bus or, you know, if she did walk across the street to the Burger King from the school. You know, we didn't know. So basically, you know, Allie being called a runaway by law enforcement, we were doing our own investigation.
Here's John talking about that.
We actually ended up having to review bus footage to make sure that she was on the bus because we were getting conflicting stories once, she had disappeared. We were getting conflicting stories from people saying that she had walked across the street from school, had met some guy and gotten a car. So Joanne and I had to literally dispel all of those myths. And I had to go to the bus facility and obtain the footage. for the cameras that were on the bus to validate that Allie did actually do what we thought she had done. So we had footage from school where there were pictures of her walking with fellow students. We saw the footage of Allie getting on the bus. We saw the footage of that whole route. And she was sitting on the bus. She was sitting next to a girl. Allie was texting and looked like she was smiling a few times as she was getting responses and just basically sitting on the bus waiting to go home. So we watched that whole bus route all the way to where she got off at her regular stop. She got off the bus along with three other boys. Those boys lived on her street as well, so they started walking down the street, and they, once Allie had disappeared, we met with those boys to try to piece together some pieces, see if they saw anything. And they said the only thing that they saw was Allie kind of lagged behind instead of walking down the street to her home. So the boys are walking down the street, Allie lagged behind, and that makes sense because the conversation that Allie and her mom had had earlier that day was that Allie was going to walk up to Burger Barn, where she was employed, and see if she could collect her pay and see if there's an opportunity for her to work that night.
So with the footage from the school and the school bus, John and Joanne were able to have some clarity. They were able to confirm that she had definitely gotten off the bus, and it coincided with the last ping from her cell phone, right on the edge of the neighborhood. They went door to door all around the neighborhood and talked to everyone they could think of that knew Allie.
The following days after that, we went to the Burger Barn and we spoke to the owner, and he confirmed that she had never shown up. We talked to the other individuals that were working there, and they said they hadn't seen her. The Burger Barn had a 24-hour surveillance internal security system, but by the time we got to him, that 24 hours had already passed, and so there was no footage to review from them. So a few days later, actually it was more than a few days, it was probably a good week, I noticed that the Shell station on the street corner there at the intersection had cameras that faced their gas pumps, and it also has a snapshot of the route that Allie would have walked from the bus stop to the Burger Barn. So we had become, I guess, good acquaintances or friends with the owners of the Shell station because they started getting very involved in our ground searches that we were operating. So I worked with the manager. He was able to obtain the footage from that day. And we obtained footage from 1 o'clock in the afternoon up until, I believe it was around 6 p.m. So a very good time there of when Allie would have been, if she had taken that route where she would have been, we would have seen her in that video. So I got the video disc from them. I reviewed it literally frame by frame by frame. Never saw her. I tried looking the best I could inside of vehicles to see if I could catch a glimpse, but the video wasn't that good, so I couldn't see if maybe she was in somebody's car. And so I did as much as I could with that video or with that disc, and I said, I can't do anything more with this. And by that time, we had obviously been involved with the local authorities and their runaway division because they had determined, or they had not determined, but they had classified Allie as a runaway or endangered runaway. So I got with the law enforcement individuals that were helping us, and I turned the disc over to them. And I said, look, I can't find out anything on this. Can you guys take it back and see if you're able to look at it, take a deeper dive into it, maybe get some license plates off of here and run license plates or something? I turned that disc over to them, and they lost it. It's extremely frustrating. You know, this is a piece of evidence. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't really call it evidence, but it's an opportunity for somebody at a high level to say, okay, I'm going to look at every license plate that goes through this intersection based on this video. And see, at least that's the way I think it, right? I'm thinking I turn this over to them. They do their NCIS stuff that they do, right? And run license plates, you know, look for anything suspicious, try to find something. And I turn it over to them with my trust, and they totally lost it. And it's extremely frustrating.
As far as the family is aware, the CD is still missing. Joanne focused on Allie's phone. They were unable to get into her actual messages and read any content, but they were able to get a hold of numbers she had called and messaged, as well as dates and times of contact.
There's a cell phone tower that's right on the outskirts of my subdivision. And through AT&T, I don't know if they still have it now, but back then it was called Family Map. And, you know, I was able to just log onto this app and see where Allie's cell phone was at any given time. And, you know, and then it also gives you like in Allie's case, and I didn't remember it until the next day that I had that because, you know, you're in such a panic and you're not thinking straight. But it was the next day that I had logged onto it to check and had last pinged her like right there, leaving the neighborhood, you know, at about the same time that the bus would let her off. If it had remained on, then it would have showed some activity. I was able to ping it myself through this AT&T app. And so that was the last activity on her phone whatsoever. So that would tell me that there was no power to that phone. It was not turned on at all. And the investigators at the time, they had, I don't remember how long it was after Allie went missing, that they had to get, a warrant or subpoena or something with AT&T to be able to get that information. And I don't remember if they were not able to get it or they got it and showed the same information. Some of the information kind of scrambles up in my brain, you know.
Allie sent up to 3,000 text messages some months. Joanne wasn't the last person she had sent a text to that day. She was in a text conversation with one of the boys. She had asked him to come over, and she was planning some kind of get-together. The text conversation ceased almost mid-conversation. According to the cell phone records you'll hear about soon, Allie was texting with other friends, making plans, and some of the conversations didn't appear finished. She seemed to have disappeared mid-conversation.
We didn't have a computer at home, because the one we had, I guess it had contracted a virus or something and just basically fried the computer. It wasn't any good. So although Allie did have a cell phone, it wasn't set up for her to get on the internet. Back then, there wasn't really a whole lot of apps and stuff. All that stuff was new. So, and I would be able to see on my AT&T plan if she had access to the internet because I didn't have any data plans back then. So it would charge me, you know, a certain amount of cents per minute that internet was used on her phone. So she knew, you know, because there was a few times where she had actually touched on the little Safari icon and charged me like $5. And I said, well, baby, this is what it does, you know, whenever you access the internet from your phone. She's like, oh, Mom, I didn't know, it was an accident. So, you know, she didn't really have anything other than, you know, texting and calling on her phone. And I still get people that ask me questions like, well, how do you know that Allie didn't have this hidden on her phone or that hidden on her phone? I'm like, well, if you think back 8 years, that didn't exist. And Allie had just gotten that cell phone at Christmas. It was her very first cell phone. She was, even though I'm sure she had some smarter friends that were good with cell phones or whatever, Allie didn't know her way around a cell phone very well. If it had remained on, then it would have showed some activity.
John and Joanne were able to remain clear with their heads. They focused on what they did know, as opposed to what they didn't. And they hoped that something would become clear, but it didn't.
So that was at 2:44 in the afternoon when Allie got off of the bus. At 2:54, all communication on her cell phone stopped, according to her cell phone records. So there were no more calls and no more texts in or out after that time. There was one girl who said that she did see Allie standing on one of the corners of the neighborhood street there, just maybe 20 or 30 feet from where the bus stopped, said that Allie was standing there and texting. Didn't look like she was doing anything or waiting on anybody. But the girl who saw her said that she didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to it and then just went into her house. And the corner where Allie was standing would make sense because that would be the route that she would walk towards the burger barn. And after that moment, no one has seen or heard from her since.
John and Joanne began printing flyers. They had nowhere to turn but believed that someone, somewhere in their community, must have seen something.
We had no idea what to do. When she went missing and really when the panic set in, we made flyers and doing everything that we could to do everything ourselves because law enforcement was telling us one story and we were trying just as hard to tell them, no, that's not true. You know, that's not Allie. She would not do this. And so we were fighting an uphill battle. We had to make our own flyers and I was driving around the city like a madman, just posting flyers anywhere I could, literally just out of my mind. I would stop and I would leave my keys in the car and leave it running and get out and just start plastering this strip center with flyers and forget that my car is over here and somebody could steal it at any time. But that's the mode that I was in. I was in a panic mode that my daughter is gone. My daughter is missing. I've got very little time to try to find out what happened. And Joanne and I just really, really worked very hard day and night to do everything that we could. You know, we were up against the police. We were up against friends and just we had to be Allie's biggest advocate. You know, we had to do everything and we didn't know what to do. And then a friend of Joanne's had got us in touch with the Laura Recovery Center. And so they were able to step in and actually start to organize ground searches and flyer distributions and just really help us through the whole thing, got the right people involved. And I think it's at that point that we started to make some progress on what to do because we didn't know what to do. And we needed that support, and fortunately it was there. But that was 3 or 4 days after she had gone missing. So there was a lot of time between the day that she went missing and the day that we got that support that we lost. That's really valuable, you know. They categorized her as a runaway because there was no witnesses. There was no witness. There was no description of a vehicle. We fought tooth and nail with the city of Houston to get an Amber Alert put out. And they told us that they couldn't put one out because we didn't have anything to go off of. We didn't have a make and model of a car. We didn't have a color. We didn't have anything like that. So we couldn't get that. And that was extremely frustrating. And we're going back and forth with law enforcement. They're telling us she's a runaway. We're telling them she's not. They're treating it as a runaway, and it was really, really difficult. You know, a runaway is endangered. They're vulnerable. They don't know what to do. Somebody befriends them, and they start to trust in that person, and that's when things go sideways. Law enforcement needs to trust and believe in the parents, too. You know, when Allie disappeared, everything in her room was still the same. All of her clothes were there. Her cell phone charger, her money, her makeup, you know, anything that was important to a 16-year-old girl at that time was still in her room. If she or any girl at that age is going to run away, somebody's going to know. You know, they talk to somebody, they made plans, I'm going to run away. And then they're going to go home and they're going to pack their stuff. they're not just going to leave it all behind. You know, so how can you sit there and say, oh, she ran away, when everything looks the same as when she left that morning? It makes absolute no sense.
4 to 5 days after Allie's disappearance, Harris County became a little more worried and went to Allie's home to have a look around and see if they could find anything.
Gosh, it was probably four or five days after Allie had been missing and the local precinct 4 still had the case. You know, they finally started to take Allie still being gone a little more seriously and, you know, decided to look around at her room. And Allie had stacks and stacks of those little black, not little, but the black bound books, the blank books that she would journal in. And that's what she liked to write in. But she kept them, most of them, in her nightstand next to her bed. Well, Allie has a matching desk and dresser in her room. And on the desk, it has one of the little overhead hutches with some sliding doors where she would keep all of her books that she read. And tucked in between those books was a spiral notebook that, like, in the middle of the book, along with some lots of other schoolwork and sketches and all kinds of stuff, you know, there was a really short paragraph that did mention, you know, running away. And that when they showed me that, you know, I thought it was very odd because the writing in it was very different from the way Allie would write in her journals, if that makes any sense. And it looked really old, not physically, but, well, I guess physically because it's writing, but it just looked really out of place. And I would think that if Allie was seriously thinking about running away, she would have been writing about it in her journals. Allie loved her eye makeup. You know, I don't know if you've seen any of her pictures or not, but Allie loved black eyeliner. You know, she loved to do her hair. She had money in her wallet, in her purse that was on her bedroom floor. You know, she loved to put her hair up, put things in her hair, you know, bows or barrettes or whatever. And, you know, even her cell phone charger was still plugged in next to her bed where it always was. So for me, not just being her mom, but, you know, for any parent, I would think that my child would want to take things with them. Still to this day, you know, law enforcement wants to use that notebook saying that, well, Allie wrote about running away. 8 years, they still want to bring that note up.
To Allie's family, there was just nothing to indicate that Allie had run away. It's just not something they will accept, and neither will Allie's friends.
I would think that if Allie did decide to leave on her own, you know, that she would have made contact with somebody by now, because that's just not who Allie is. Allie loves her friends, and John describes it as her creature comforts of home. I just can't see Allie just dropping everything just to be with the boy. I mean, she would be 24 years old now. I mean, that's an adult. She would have a driver's license, hopefully a job, you know, if she were out there of her own free will. Even though Allie had just turned 16, she didn't have a driver's license. She didn't have a Texas ID. The only thing she had was her student ID from school. And that's not going to get you anywhere. We've got her passport and her social security card. So she has no ID, no legal ID, wherever she is.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. They knew that Allie had a new boyfriend. They weren't serious, but they seemed to like each other a lot. But she was also talking to another boy.
We first talked to DJ, who was the boy that she had started having an interest in, or dating, if you will. But he was of no real concern. He was looking for her, too. He hadn't seen her, and he was a very mild-mannered kid. He was at home the whole time that during the hours that Allie had disappeared, his mother vouched for him, so he was of no concern. There was another boy that she had been texting with, and Jay had been over to the house a couple times, so I knew that they were friends. And that was the last, or one of the last few records in Allie's phone, was Jay's phone number. So I found out where Jay lived, and I went to speak with him. And he said, no, I don't know. I spoke with Jay's father. I turned their information over to authorities so that they could follow up on him, and nothing ever came of that. So, yeah, we did follow up on them. There was another guy at the Burger Barn that he went by the name, nickname Crash, and he was of concern because he was 20 or 21. I can't remember his exact age, but he wanted to date Allie, and Allie's 16. So he became a quick suspect. And so, you know, I spoke with him. I had actually had a conversation with him prior to all of this when I found out that he wanted to take Allie out. And so I went to the Burger Barn and sat down with this young man and said, you need to understand that she is 16 years old and you are 20 or 21, whatever age he was, and you can't do that. And so we were very clear on that. And so that was obviously prior to Allie's disappearance. So I think a few weeks later is when Allie had disappeared. So he immediately became a person of interest to me and Joanne. We turned his information over to law enforcement. Law enforcement went to his residence, determined that he didn't have anything to do with it, didn't know anything about it, and that just maybe he was just a young kid, but they cleared him and said he didn't have anything to do with it. Those were the ones that we really took a hard look at in the beginning. Everybody else was just as concerned as we were with Allie's whereabouts, Allie's best friends, Allie's close friends. So there was nobody in her immediate circle that we felt was any kind of threat. Outside of that circle, there were some individuals that we were concerned with. There were some girls that had bullied Allie, getting off of the bus on several occasions, and actually got off the bus prior to her disappearance, they had got off the bus with her at the same time and threatened to beat her up, chased her home. And so Allie was afraid of them. They became a person of a people of interest. And I think law enforcement cleared them. Oh, and there were some other kids at school that Allie was kind of having a little bit of a difficult time with. Just teenage drama, right? So we engaged with them, talked to them. We didn't see anything there. Law enforcement talked to them. They didn't find anything there. Through everybody that we spoke with, everybody that we felt may have had something against Allie, we talked to everybody that we could.
The case was handed over to the homicide squad in late May of that year. And this is when the search kicked into a new gear. As with any murder or possible murder investigation, law enforcement first looked at home. This was something that neither John, Joanne, or Mason were prepared for. After feeling alone in their search for Allie, suddenly they found themselves in the police spotlight. The men were interrogated and their alibis checked. All three underwent numerous polygraph tests. In the end, all three passed. They also provided their DNA so that it could go on file if it ever needed to be matched. These are the things that go on behind the scenes of a case. Homicide detectives wouldn't necessarily tell a family if a Jane Doe had shown up on the system, which may be a match to Allie. To save the heartache, they keep the DNA on file.
All of us were polygraphed. They didn't do an interrogation on me. I still can't figure that out, why they didn't. But, you know, John and Mason both had alibis, and my alibi was being at work. John was at work. Mason was with friends, you know, the circle of friends confirmed it. You know, at the time, it was very frustrating because from my point of view, it's like, why the hell are you wasting so much time on us when you can be out there really looking for Allie? Being 8 years later, I understand now that they have to clear the family first.
All registered sex offenders were looked into, to no avail.
And there were actually quite a few pings in the area when you go on the website of registered offenders. And so there was an effort to go to those individuals and speak with them, but clearly they did not know anything about it, had no involvement, whatever the case was. So all of those individuals in that immediate area were cleared, even though there was a surprising number.
Another teenage girl came forward saying that someone had stopped her and attempted to abduct her. Joanne has never heard anything further from the police about this, so she assumes that it was unrelated.
Actually, that was one of Allie's friends that lived on the next block. And actually, we didn't hear about that until after Allie had gone missing, that the girl, I think she was on the track team. She was in some type of athletics, and she was actually jogging. It was a Monte Carlo that she said had come up next to her, and they tried to grab her. She was able to fight her way away from them and get home. There's a lot of things that we would hope that law enforcement did check into that may have been related to Allie's disappearance, but they don't like to share their information. And I would think that if they did make a connection on that, then we probably would have heard it by now.
They've explored every option imaginable, and Allie's parents are willing to explore any lead that comes their way.
Our area, I mean, we hear reports all the time now, and I don't know if it's because, you know, of social media and everybody, the word gets around a lot better, but sometimes it seems like it's a weekly basis that you hear on the news that somewhere on the west side that there was a van, you know, at a school and blah, blah, blah. It seems like it just comes and it goes in waves. And I'm like, why can't anybody ever make any connection with these people? And then you see these videos on Facebook where there's men that are as so bold as to try to steal these little girls in a grocery store. It's insane. And that's one thing that me and John still struggle with. Was it a complete stranger, or was it somebody that she knew when she got into the car with them, not knowing any better? Yeah, I would say that that's the, you know, the hardest thing. That I can't speak for John, but there's got to be somebody out there, you know, that knows something. Why aren't they coming forward?
There was one witness who apparently saw a girl talking to someone in a truck that day.
That tip that came in was from a pizza delivery guy. He worked at Mr. Jim's Pizza, which is in the same shopping strip as the Burger Barn. They were just like a couple of suites down from them. And he says that he saw a truck speaking to a young lady on Cypresswood, which would have been like a half a mile north the direction that Allie was walking. And the same tipster, he had written down the license plate to the truck, but at the time he didn't know that Allie was missing, and he said he cleaned out his car and he threw it away. Our very first private investigator says that he took this man to be hypnotized to get the license plate number, but that information recently has been found to be false, that the private investigator never did that. I remember him coming up to the place where we were staging the ground searches and him speaking to the people from the Laura Recovery Center. And I don't know if he specifically said I don't think he gave a description of what the girl looked like. And I think mainly he just, you know, described the truck and then the activity that was going on.
John and Joanne, with the help of the Laura Recovery Center, who helped find missing and abducted children, set up a new search, which included groups of people and horses. They helped to create posters and go door to door knocking. They also had a tracking dog go along the route that Allie would have taken. The dog picked up Allie's scent, but it could not be determined if it was a fresh trail or one which had been there for some time. Allie's boyfriend was cleared, but she had also been texting another boy that day. John went to speak to him, and it didn't go too well. He was later cleared by the police as well.
Well, by investigators, yes, he's been ruled out. There was one instance where John had gone over there to speak with him, you know, personally. You know, because law enforcement, when they do their investigation, they won't really tell you their findings. And I understand that they have to do their own thing. It was driving me and John crazy. So John went over there. John was met by a very aggressive father, Jay's dad. I don't remember the exact conversation, but I just remember that John said that his father was very rude and angry, and it didn't go very far, basically.
It's unclear why it took so long. Perhaps the teens were scared that they might get in trouble. But it took a couple of years before some of Allie's friends came forward and said that Allie was speaking with an older guy at the time.
A couple of her girlfriends had said that they didn't know anything. They hadn't heard from her. Allie didn't say anything. But a couple of years after that, after speaking to them again, our current private investigator, they said, well, you know, there was this boy that she was talking to. We didn't say anything at the time because we didn't want to get Allie in trouble, because they were thinking that she was coming back, you know, and that everything was going to be okay. But there have been rumors that Allie was talking to an older boy that had a vehicle. And the rumors at school were that she had ran away with this boy and is living in Florida in her uncle's attic. I think that's what the rumor was. But we really have not been able to pinpoint any viable information on that tip. Nobody knows who this guy was. You know, no, we haven't been able to locate any friends that knew a name or could confirm 100% that this has happened.
John's skeptical of this story. With all the research that they've done, they've never found any evidence to support it.
There was probably a few phone numbers here and there, but they were more of like one-offs. It wasn't like very consistent where they couldn't identify who the person was. I'd say probably 98% of them had been with people that she knew. And I guess my thought on that is, if she's communicating with somebody on a regular basis and maybe it's a predator of some sort, then there would be some sort of trail, right? So no computer, there was no true trail in Allie's phone records, and there was nothing else that would suggest that she was talking to anybody else. We even looked into her friends' phones to say, okay, if she wasn't using her phone, maybe she was using somebody else's to make these communications. And so we got with her close circle of friends, and none of that had ever happened.
The following information has come from a private investigator who has been working with the family at no cost. We were unsuccessful in arranging an official interview with the private investigator for this episode, and so it's very difficult to confirm any validity to the following, but I'm sharing it in case it could help in any way. According to this private investigator, Allie had an email address that no one was aware of. It was not the email that her family knew about. It was created after she got her cell phone the Christmas before she disappeared. In 2014, the family's private investigator says that she found this email address. I've not seen this for myself, but apparently, 6 weeks after Allie disappeared, this particular email address was accessed in Las Vegas, Nevada, using her own password. It was not accessed from her cell phone. This was never turned back on again after she disappeared. But apparently, her email was accessed some other way. According to the private investigator, Allie had been in contact with a phone number which no one recognized, one that linked back to an escort service based in Las Vegas, Nevada. This is why the private investigator leans towards the idea that Allie was trafficked.
No leads have been the right leads, I should say. As far as saying a good lead, you know, we get tips all the time saying that, oh, well, this girl looks like Allie. And they'll send me pictures that they found on Facebook. And, you know, to a parent, nobody looks like your child. We still continue to get people that will send us pictures thinking that it may be Allie. Now, the tips where we're not able to get pictures are the tips that we look at a little bit closer to try to find someone that has been an eyewitness to the person they claim has seen Allie. So I guess the best one of those was the one where we went to Columbus, Ohio.
There's never been a lead that has led John and Joanne any closer to answers. From this Columbus lead, the private investigator believed that she had tracked Allie to Ohio and that she was involved in the sex trade. The private investigator began an undercover operation to find Allie. An entire operation ensued where the private investigator, posing as a sex worker, infiltrated a group and inside a house known for drug and sex activity. She believed that she would find Allie. This sting was featured in an episode of Disappeared, where John and Joanne were brought to Columbus and were waiting in the wings, hoping for the safe return of their daughter, only to find out that the girl, by then, was long gone. But they learned that it was unlikely to have been Allie. John and Joanne went home heartbroken. Another case was brought up in relation to Allie's disappearance. The now-convicted murderer Brendan Laverne was looked into. He had a sister living nearby. He was known to drive a truck and had been in the area around the time of Allie's disappearance. It was later found out that on the day of Allie's disappearance, he wasn't in the area, and there was no way he could have been responsible.
There for a while, when we were looking at him, and we were looking at him because he had a sister that lived not too far from me, and he had been in the area at the time that Allie had gone missing, but it wasn't on the exact same dates. But at the time, because they were like, you know, Brandon owned a white truck, and, you know, he was here with the white truck when Allie went missing, and he burned a truck. Well, the truck that he was driving at the time, it wasn't a white truck. He had owned multiple trucks, I think, for something to do with his business or his dad's business or something. So there wasn't things that actually added up to him being a viable suspect in Allie's case.
Here's John talking about getting tips and dealing with all the information.
We were getting tips all over the place. And quite honestly, the white truck just really kind of blew up out of proportion. The white truck was apparently seen in the opposite direction that Allie would have gone. It was northbound on Cypresswood, and somebody said that they saw a white truck pulled over talking to some girl. And if Allie was going to the burger barn, that was in complete opposite directions, and Allie would have no business going in the direction that they said that they saw this. So it doesn't make sense. What really frustrates me about that is the PI that we had at that time really, really honed in on this white truck. And then it kind of blew up into the Brandon Laverne thing, and it was a really, 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 really terrible lead. Law enforcement did their due diligence. Our PI did their due diligence. They checked everything. It was almost like, okay, Allie's disappeared, and now this happens over here, so there's got to be some sort of tie because he had ties back to the Houston area. But I do appreciate that they really dug in as much as they did. You know, they really dug in. They did their due diligence. He was cleared and apparently has nothing to do with it. I just think that there's thousands of white trucks on the road. And for somebody to come and say, hey, I saw a girl talking to a person in a white truck, totally opposite of the direction that Allie was going, I just didn't see anything there.
Joanne has found solace in her Facebook community. She has a page set up for Allie, who would now be 24 years old. She's also created a local support group for missing people and their families. They get together every 3 to 4 months, and she finds that each time there might be different people. The Texas Center for the Missing allows them to use space in their office. She also runs a private Facebook group called Moms of the Missing. The only requirement for joining that group is that you must be the mother of a missing child.
It's like a safe place, you know, where we can share things with each other. And I've got over 100 moms that are a part of this group that are all over the world. We know what each other's going through. When there's an article or something that comes out and something's posted on someone else's page, I'll go and read the comments. And I think a lot of people may not know that we keep up with stuff like that, but I do. I know that there's some moms out there that don't care to read all the comments, but I do. And there's very a lot of comments out there that really upset me. And it's like, gosh, what if that was your child? You know, would you want somebody to say that about you? I've had comments all the way from, well, gosh, no wonder Allie ran away, you know, with a mom like that, or, you know, she should just give up. Allie's dead. I've had it all the way from A to Z. It's disturbing, you know, and I think I posted on my own page today. It's like, you know, once you write something or you say something to somebody, you can't undo it. A lot of people on the internet, they don't think like that. They just think, oh, I'll just type it and then I'll go about my own way, you know, and it's not like that. I do one benefit once a year for Allie, and it's not just to keep the reward fund going, but it's also for awareness. And my best friend had gone to a local businessman. He owned a hardware store here on the corner, and she went in to ask for something to donate for the auction. And he basically told her, well, why doesn't she just give up? You know, it's like beating a dead horse. She had become so upset. I was angry because she was angry and upset. And I'm just like, God, you know, why? If this man had a missing child, you know, would he want to be told that? There's power in what you say. And it's just people don't think of it like that, though.
So what does Joanne believe happened to Allie?
We don't have any proof that Allie's dead or alive. Well, I guess the only proof we don't have is that she's not dead, because most cases, from stuff that I've learned, that and this is hard to even think of and say, but there's no body yet. Most cases, something has been found. Most of the time, you know, a bone or something. And, you know, my heart drops every time that there's been a body found or, you know, remains found, and especially locally, you know, until we actually find a body that Allie is still alive out there. But, you know, I want people to know that Allie is a real person. And this is always the hardest part because it just makes me miss her even more. But I think what people don't remember is that these people, you know, Allie is a real person and she's kind and caring and she's artistic and she loves her animals and she loves to draw. You know, she was a Girl Scout and she loves to sing. You know, and her friends love her and miss her just like I do. I don't know. I feel like there's so many things I want to say, but I just can't get them out. But that's my biggest fear, is that people will just forget about Allie just because she's not here. I really do try anything and everything I can think of, but, you know, it never feels like it's enough. I really struggle with that.
As for John, he too keeps an open mind, but he feels that Allie being alone, walking to work that day, was the perfect opportunity for a predator.
Because I don't think that somebody could pull this off without knowing what to do. I'm very saddened that Allie didn't have somebody else with her. And not to sound cliche or anything, but the buddy system, I think if somebody else had been with Allie, that we probably wouldn't be having this conversation right now. I don't think that anybody that Allie knew could really be capable of this. Which kind of makes me believe that it was a straight-up stranger abduction. Now, again, we don't have any witnesses, we don't have anything, and that's extremely frustrating. It's just like 1 minute she's there and she's gone. I think if something would have happened, the circle that Allie knew or was associated with, that something would have broke by now. Right, somebody would have ratted somebody out. Somebody would have felt guilty about something. I just can't humanly fathom somebody that close to Allie, whether it's in her inner circle or expanded, could do something to her or to anyone for that matter. They're kids. They're high school kids. You know, somebody's going to tell on somebody. Somebody's going to start feeling guilty, that kind of thing. And at least that's what I would hope would happen. With what happened, I truly believe that whoever did it knew exactly what they were doing. Just for the simple fact that Allie was very active on her phone. She was phone calls and she would text. When we got her phone records, she averaged 3,000 texts in a month. And for all of that to stop immediately tells me that whoever did what they did knew exactly what they were doing and knew how to do it. I think we're at a point now where we've done so much. What's left? What do we do next? You know, we try to drum up as much attention as we can to keep it out there in the public so that people are keeping their eyes open and maybe someday something will break. But we've done so much over these 8 years, it's almost like, what else can we do? You know, Allie just completely disappeared. There's no witnesses. There's no nothing. The video is gone. We can't even look at the vehicles that were entering that intersection for that 5 or 6 hour period. The only thing that we can really assume at this point is it was a straight up abduction and now she's involved in some sort of trafficking or something else has happened. It's so difficult to not have that closure. It's so difficult to not have any witnesses. It's so difficult to just have nothing. I mean, you're literally looking for a needle in a haystack. And I just hope and pray that one day, whoever did this knows somebody, and that other person knows this as well, and they get into a fight, and the other one rats the other one out. That's how desperate it is for me. I just hope that something like that happens. It would be almost too much to ask for somebody who knows about it to actually have a human conscience and go, you know what, that was wrong, and I'm sorry. You know, and come forward. I don't see that happening, but in my world of wishes, I wish that would happen. I just wish somebody would come forth and tell us what happened. Let us have some closure and let us have some peace. You know, bring my daughter back home.
So what happened to Allie Lowitzer after she got off the bus on April 26, 2010? Was she really planning to walk to the burger barn like she had told her mom, and something happened along the way? Did she get into a vehicle with someone she knew, or possibly a stranger? Was the story about walking to Burger Barn a cover for what Allie had really planned to do that afternoon? Was someone with bad intentions secretly communicating with her and set up a meeting that day? How did Allie simply vanish while walking down the road and no one saw a thing? Could Allie still be out there and be the victim of human trafficking? After all of these years, none of the leads have panned out. For John and Joanne, they still have hope that one of these days, a solid lead will come in and give them the opportunity to bring their daughter home. Allie's friends and family have raised a $25,000 reward for any information leading to Allie's return. At the time of her disappearance, she was 5'2" tall and weighed about 145 pounds. Allie was 16 at the time and would now be 24 years old. If you have any information about the disappearance of Allie Lowitzer, please contact the Harris County Sheriff's Office at 713-221-6000.
You want to try to match the pieces of the puzzle up as much as you can. And, you know, unfortunately, we've been unable to do that with everybody that we've had on our suspect list. You know, I try to compare different cases that I watch or I listen to all the time, you know, thinking that could this same scenario be Allie's scenario? You know, I've even thought about the case of Skylar Niece, you know, where her two best friends killed her. And I even had thought about, well, could that have been Allie's scenario? Because Allie definitely would have willingly go with any of her friends. And I'm thinking, I just don't see any of her friends doing that. And then you hear about the cases, you know, where there's a neighbor down the street that was a pedophile that nobody knew about, abducted Allie and, you know, is holding her in the basement or whatever. And we did canvassing, you know, we went door to door and met all the neighbors and, you know, everybody was interviewed and talked to. And, you know, all the way from, you know, that to watching the true crime stuff on TV, you know, I just haven't been able to match anything in my own mind with the knowledge that I know of the case. The only thing that we know is that somebody did take her.
It's amazing that even within the first month of her disappearance, people were still telling us, oh, I thought she was found. Oh, I heard she was found. And we're like, no, she's not. It was very frustrating. Yeah, we've had to do a lot of damage control, and we've had to do a lot of bringing it back together, you know, because it starts to grow tentacles and people are starting to hear different things through the rumor mill, and it's just not true, and we kind of have to start to bring it all back in and say, no, nothing's changed. This is still what's going on. Joanne and I have worked extremely hard over the last 8 years to just keep it out there. And Joanne has done a fantastic job. She's a huge advocate for missing persons and the families of those missing people. Just what she's done over the 8 years for support and keeping it alive is just, it amazes me what she's been able to do. You don't know where to turn. The people that are around you, the friends and family, they sympathize with you, but they don't know exactly how it feels. So having that support of others around you that have been through that, I think is very important, because you have a voice, you've got somebody to talk to that understands the feelings. You get different ideas on what to do and how to do things, and maybe some person did this and another person hadn't done that before, so maybe they go try it. So it becomes a bit of a community, if you will.
That brings us to the end of episode 156. I'd like to thank Joanne and John for taking the time to speak with me for the show. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There's a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Minnesota. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.